Hi, this is Lex, and welcome to the FinTech Blueprint. It's your podcast about fintech, decentralized finance, digital banking, investing, robo-advice, artificial intelligence, and all the other frontier technology that is transforming financial services. To get more content, like an illustrated transcript of this conversation in your inbox, subscribe at fintechblueprint.com. So without further delay, let's jump into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. I'm really excited about today's conversation with John McElwain. He's the co-founder and CEO at Highnote, a really exciting fintech company that was founded in 2020, but also somebody who has incredible operating and technology experience all across fintech, financial services, payments, asset management, and so on. So I'm extremely excited to hop into the conversation and explore these topics. John, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Lex. Thanks a lot. Great to be here. Really looking forward to the conversation today.
My pleasure. I was saying before we started recording, you know, going into your background is going to be like going through all the companies that we focus on and cover from a tech perspective. Can we just, you know, start at the beginning and talk about how you got your start in tech and in finance and, you know, what that journey was like, what brought you there?
Sure, would be happy to. Let's go way back to the beginning, which is sort of graduating from the University of Michigan with a computer engineering degree. And I've always been fascinated by technology, and I ended up living in London for my first couple of years out of school and kind of just worked in the technology field in the insurance market, in the Lloyd's market over in London, and was excited to just get into technology and finance and understand, you know, some of the different dimensions. And I think overall in my career, I feel very fortunate to have been able to work in, you know, many different, I guess, segments of financial services. And I'll walk through some of those, but getting a good perspective of technology and finance and business models at both, you know, smaller startup companies as well as large established organizations has been exciting and rewarding. And so after London, I relocated to California and became part of the company that was building the very first online brokerage application on the internet. And I remember those days where, you know, long time ago, the browsers were just coming along and people were exploring the internet and really understanding how to connect people to financial infrastructure, i.e. trading systems and actually the exchange itself, you know, presented a number of different challenges and problems that were not just technical, but process problems and workflow and business rules and really understanding, connecting modern technology with legacy infrastructure. And we got into the brokerage business pretty naively, thinking, hey, we'll just connect some APIs from the front end all the way down to the exchange, only to realize that there weren't any APIs that connected to the exchange. People were interfacing brokerage markets with 3270 green screen kind of mainframe front ends. And so that was our first major hurdle to try to figure out how to do that. But it was all about, you know, going into new markets and understanding how to apply newer technologies to, I think in many ways, enable growing businesses. And so that was kind of the start of my thinking and my excitement and interest in working with very smart people that wanted to solve real business problems through technology. And so ended up working for a company called Lombard Brokerage. We sold the company to, at that point, Dean Witter, who then merged with Morgan Stanley. And I stayed with Morgan Stanley for several years in the brokerage environment. And then from there, I moved through another startup in San Francisco before landing in Chicago at a company called Envestnet, which is really in the asset management side of the business. So understanding capital markets and investment. I don't know if you know Envestnet, but...
But before hopping over to Envestnet, I'm quite interested in the Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter experience. This was kind of leading up into the late 90s and early 2000s, right around the advent of the internet, where everything was going to be internet enabled. And of course, it ended up being that way. What was the climate and the feeling inside of a company you know, at the time, which was none of this financial crisis stuff, right? Like very powerful, very prestigious. Like, can you talk about the posture of a company like Morgan Stanley towards internet brokerage and what that was like?
Yeah, sure. So it's an interesting dichotomy between sort of Dean Witter, who is a large sort of brokerage environment, you know, full service brokerage, and Morgan Stanley in the investment management side. And so just that combination alone created a lot of internal change. And I think that our company really gravitated towards where Morgan Stanley wanted to go, which is kind of thinking about how the internet could transform not only investment banking, but brokerage as a whole. And so our company was acquired because of the platform and the ability to have an offering that could empower a human broker with tools, with capabilities, but also service a direct market. So a self-service market where people could go on the internet, place trades, perform research. And then if they needed help, they could leverage a human broker. And so it was trying to figure out that transformation from sort of full service to full self-service and then everything in between, which was where Morgan Stanley was thinking about. And so I was part of I remember the days with the e-commerce steering committee at Morgan Stanley that was, you know, chaired by John Mack and Phil Purcell and had Mary Meeker and, you know, a lot of the team there really at the cusp of internet kind of technologies and business models. And it was a really exciting time, to be honest with you. It was fascinating to kind of be someone who was able to introduce a lot of the real technology, a real environment that was leveraging the internet with a business model, and try to think about how to complement, you know, a prestigious kind of institution like Morgan Stanley with the right capabilities. So that was a really exciting time there.
And people took it seriously. Like it wasn't like a side project. It wasn't like there wasn't an allergy to this new emerging stuff.
I mean, I think, Lex, there was some of that for sure. It was new. And so, you know, with change, there's always many different perspectives on, is this real? Is this a fad? Is this going to pass? But as time went on and as the adoption of the capabilities, as the internet was really, during those times, it was really the run-up of the bubble, if you will. And so lots of excitement, lots of adoption. And I think our model was somewhat of a real model, meaning we were offering real capabilities that were beneficial. Someone who doesn't have to pick up the phone and call a broker and say, you know, what is IBM trading at? And then they get a quote from the broker and they say, okay, thank you, I'd like to place a trade. Like removing all of that friction and just allowing someone to log in on the internet and place that trade. It sounds obvious now, but this was way back when those capabilities didn't exist. And so that type of enablement and that the whole experience was empowering. That's a real business model. And so I think as people began to kind of view that in that way, it became to you know, really took on more traction, and we received more investment, and, you know, we rebranded a couple of times and eventually became Morgan Stanley Online. And the rest, I guess, was history.
Absolutely. I think it's just fascinating how some of the things that people feel are just happening for the first time now, and, you know, this digital transformation has actually been on a gradual and difficult ascent for decades. Okay, so you got to Envestnet, which is a, now you'd call a wealth tech for, you know, for asset management, for financial advisors. What happened there?
Yeah, so that was an interesting business where that was really, again, kind of carrying on with the theme of empowering people through technology. And so in this case, it was asset managers and providing a sort of a technology platform to allow them to properly kind of assess and create, you know, portfolios in the institutional money management business. And so that was a really exciting sort of, I think, opportunity to understand the needs of an advisor, the needs of capital markets and investments and diversity, and in a way that was bringing tools and capabilities to not to the end consumer as much as to an advisor. And so I was there for a while in Chicago and being recruited into a company called SunGard, which since has been acquired into is now FIS. But at that time, SunGard was a large conglomerate. And that was the first environment where I was part of a real product company that was sort of shipping product versus kind of a web services. But it was, again, it was all about modernization. I was working on as CTO, heading up the largest kind of mutual fund accounting system platform, which may not sound super exciting, but it was really the platform that was used by, at that point, 40 or 50% of all mutual funds were striking an NAV using this application. And again, legacy application, sort of COBOL technologies, not web friendly, and looking to really move into modernization. And so applying some of the kind of the experiences that I had in the past, I was brought on to really modernize some of these major technology products for SunGard. And I was there for 3 or 4 years as CTO before being recruited over to Visa to essentially, I started off there running their web front end capabilities. So some may not know, but at that point, Visa had a lot of obviously customers and a need for customers to manage, you know, their disputes or their processing transactions or reports through web-based interfaces. So I joined in that capacity, but then continued to be given more and more responsibility to the point where I was running all of global development at Visa, which essentially was all revenue-generating applications at Visa, as well as the databases there, which was fascinating. My background was in database technology. And so really seeing sort of the information architecture for Visa and knowing that, you know, every single Visa transaction around the world eventually was found its way into the data warehouse within, you know, at that point, I think it was 10 or 15 seconds was really fascinating. So I could go on and on about the Visa days, but that was a really exciting opportunity.
I want to pause here for another moment because this is another kind of platform shift, 2007 to 2011. And, you know, the context of that time is the economist saying data is the new oil, and the social networks emerging to become, you know, these machine learning kind of machines at very large scale powered by information. And, you know, fintech was also getting packaged by Silicon Valley for the first time on top of Web 2.0 with the idea that you've got applications running in the cloud, you know, it's Google Docs, not Microsoft Office, and everything's interactive. And so kind of this formation of Web 2 and the idea of personal data and data aggregation being very valuable. And I think around that time, actually, you know, Yodlee was powering Mint.com, which now sits within Envestnet at your old employer. What was your view as you were building out applications for Visa around this framing of, you know, financial data and data being valuable and kind of aggregation? Like, was that clear? Was that visible? Sort of, do you remember what that felt like?
I did. It's a great question. And, you know, it was always at the forefront of what we were trying to deliver and sort of accomplish. And i.e., the question was, who owns the data once a card is swiped? And at that point, there are answers around, well, the consumer owns it, of course, because it's their card. There were other opinions of, well, the bank owns it because they're the ones who issued the card. And then there was the perspective of, well, at some point, VisaNet owns it because they're augmenting the data. They're responsible for switching it. And so, therefore, there's a component of data elements that only Visa is providing and has visibility to. And so, therefore, they have a piece of the ownership. And these are pretty big problems to wrestle down in terms of finding that answer. But we were pushing that because we, in my organization, were innovating around data and the experience. As a specific example, our team built the very first capability where when you swipe your card, if you've enrolled in this platform that we built, you could receive a real-time text message saying, hey, we just saw your card was authorized for, you know, $27 at a shop. That's obviously commonplace now. Everybody has that. But back then, no bank offered that. And it was really centralized. It was a really centralized capability at Visa. The issue that introduced was, okay, if we're enrolling a customer to this capability, does the bank participate in that? Does that go through a bank portal for the customer to enroll? And if that alert is delayed, who's liable for that if they sign? So all these sort of issues came about in terms of data ownership and aggregation and then value add on top of that. Your example around sort of Yodlee investment, I mean, there's a clear opt-in from the consumer that you know, says, yes, you can aggregate my data. But it became less clear when you're talking about sort of, I think, transaction information. And of course, many other products kind of carried on from there. If you're getting an alert from a Starbucks transaction, maybe we could offer a discount or a coupon at the point of sale, because at Visa, you know, it doesn't require an integration with the acquiring technologies. It's really centralized. And so that opens up a whole other massive business in my mind, which sort of goes to the unification of online and offline advertising. And all of this to say, and sorry to sort of go into all these things that are super exciting to me, but all of this is to say, the core issue is who owns the data and who's allowed to provide value-add services on top of that. And to kind of close the chapter on that, when I left, the answer was really looking like it was going to end up being the banks owned that data. And so these programs that we were interested in launching really had to go through bank support and sponsorship. And so that, of course, slowed everything down. It's come to fruition now. Like now you sign up for your bank and you almost by default get text and notifications if you want. But back then it was pretty.
Yeah, it's also kind of a bummer. I guess that's the technical way to think about it. But kind of a bummer that a bunch of folks had to break a bunch of rules or, you know, push past the point of comfort for the industry to form. You know, like, so you sound very thoughtful about who owns the data and being careful about it. And, you know, end of the day, what seems to have happened is that the people who could crowbar the data out or who could, you know, scrape it at scale or could, you know, through sort of third party internet activity, divine the data through regressions, ended up kind of cranking into the opportunity. But that's for another day. Okay, so we're out of Visa. Where are we going next?
Yeah, let's go to, we can skip over Green Dot. I was there for a very short period of time. That can be for another day as well, but that's a prepaid business down in LA. But from Green Dot, I was recruited into Lending Club at very early days of Lending Club. There's probably 50 or 60 people in the company. And I was brought in to lead the technology teams. And that was a great experience in rethinking kind of the credit markets in the sense of how to provide risk-adjusted credit to consumers and provide, on the other side of the network, is a two-sided network, investment returns to both retail consumers and corporate investors. And so the model was pretty exciting to rethink lending. And I was there for a little over 4 years, went, built the team, launched into several different markets. I went through the IPO and the CEO departure and then stayed for about a year after that. But I don't know how much you're interested in the credit markets, but I think that whole business has gone through a number of different changes and innovations, and it was pretty exciting to be part of all that.
Obviously a fantastic and groundbreaking company. I think, you know, one of the things that's really compelling about your background, and of course we'll get to Highnote and how it all comes together, but one of the things is just, first off, the payments infrastructure and the asset management and investing and brokerage infrastructure and the lending and underwriting technology stacks are quite different. So it's really impressive that you spent the calories to do all of it bottoms up in that way. But then I guess the question I'm going to drive to is maybe a connection between the technology and the model for these things. So, you know, the way I think about brokerage and to some extent payments is money in motion. And that requires a certain type of architecture and transaction processing, and the needs of that business and the things that support money in motion are quite different from money at rest, which in my mind are kind of closer to InvestNet and SunGard and, you know, assets under management and deposits and a bank and sitting on top of a large pile rather than sending it around in small amounts. When looking at the lending stack and looking at underwriting and these peer-to-peer transactions, what was the business like more? Was it fast money in motion, or was it this big balance sheet that needed to be managed? And, you know, is the whole framework even right? Like, could you talk about that mapping?
Yeah, it's sort of really interesting to think about it in the following way. So I would say Lending Club was primarily money at rest. So in the brokerage environment, I remember late, you know, we were scaling late night, Sunday night. I could see the queue of orders coming up that all needed to get executed at 6:30 a.m. And that's the sort of business where you cannot afford to drop an order on the floor or to miss a transaction, right? Because it's real time, it's money that's transacting, and it's the stakes are, I think, very, very high financially for types of systems that you have to design and to scale and to have redundancies. Not to say that that didn't exist at LendingClub, but primarily you're talking about transactions that aren't as real time. It's not a market type environment. Having said that, the way that LendingClub was sort of architected, and I think primarily still is that you're talking about fractional loans. And so, you know, the whole model is investors can invest a little for a little piece of a loan all the way down to, I think at that time it was $50 or $100 or something. And so the technology was responsible for breaking up all of these loans into thousands of pieces and therefore being responsible for the money flows in and out for each of those individual pieces. And so that was occurring on a nightly basis, i.e. payments come in, they have to get distributed out to these thousands and hundreds of thousands of fractional loan components and then accounted for with, you know, interest and fees and principal payments, et cetera. And so I joined, there was an architecture that performed this sort of on a nightly basis, otherwise known as this batch. But because of the growth and success and just the sheer volume increases, we were introduced with another technical problem, which was the batch processing was approaching 12, 15 hours to complete. And as you know, if a daily batch process goes beyond 24 hours, like you kind of go over the cliff, right? Because you're on to the next day. And so it sounds like a simple technical problem, but it was actually required quite a bit of re-architecture. And in many ways was as challenging as the real-time order flow, you know, ensuring that transactions occur without fail in the brokerage environment. So it was kind of a mix of both, but to answer your question, you know, that environment was primarily in the money at rest side of things. So I had to put it in one of the other buckets.
Cool. Makes a lot of sense. So you were with LendingClub through 2017 and then on to payments again. Is that right?
Payments again. Yeah. And I sort of felt like, I think my heart and my passion is really in payments because I do feel like the amount of innovation that's occurring and feels like it's continuing to evolve is exciting, and it's sort of real time and it's enabling different business models to emerge. And let's face it, almost everybody is connected in some way to the payments infrastructure, and that's not the case with lending and, you know, not necessarily the case with brokerage. And so I just felt like there was an ability to have a major impact in ways that were far reaching, and I still believe that. So joined Braintree as head of product and technology. Braintree, as you know, is the acquiring arm for PayPal. Really great organization that I joined. Very, very tech-centric, large customers at scale. I'm sort of going head-to-head with a lot of the payments acquiring businesses. And it was exciting to get a little bit deeper. At Visa, it was sort of a different angle around payments. And Braintree is really about supporting customers on a day-to-day basis, ensuring that they're enabled and that their experiences are great, and they're expanding into different geo territories and offering new products and also leveraging what PayPal could bring to the table, obviously with their consumer wallet, their distribution, and really leveraging the best of a large company, i.e. PayPal, but feeling as if we're operating with a small organization that was kind of tech focused and could move very quickly. And so that was the Braintree experience. I then was promoted into CEO or general manager for the last year I was there. Got a really good perspective on running the business globally and with, you know, full responsibility for P&L and future growth.
So just to point out the obvious, this was another platform shift a decade after the Web 2 one, but which is now people frame as embedded finance. But you're going from, we can put information on the internet for people to see in the late 90s, and then you're going to, we can put software for anyone to use into websites and browsers in the late 2000s. And in this time period, we're talking about actually developers can connect to all of these services in a really open way with easy, beautifully designed documentation, and you can start putting payments in there and investing in there and banking in there, you know, and of course crypto, and we see more and more of that actualize all across fintech today. And so that takes us to, you know, your CEO experience for the Braintree business. Takes us to your founder experience with Highnote. What was it like to step into that role, you know, into a different lens where you're essentially starting from the beginning, and how did you get to the idea around that?
So I think the first sort of thought around what did it feel like, it felt a lot like my very first role that we talked about, which was the online brokerage, which was really thinking about how to build something from scratch. And so since that was such a long time ago in my career, it was sort of, hey, this feels similar, yet it's very, very different given the experiences and sort of the knowledge and sort of understanding of what it takes to build a business, having worked at, you know, such great companies and really learning through that. And the idea when I left PayPal or Braintree in March was initially to, you know, take a fair amount of time off and just think and talk to people and really look at the opportunities. And to be honest with you, at that time, I really felt like the acquiring business was exciting and filled with opportunity, primarily around data. So my thinking was, hey, I think there's something around a Braintree 2.0 and the next generation of capability on the acquiring side. And as I got deeper into research and talking to, you know, a lot of smart people and, you know, looking at the banking as a service space and those platforms that are out there and what were they doing and how were they constructed and what was the value. I got connected into a couple companies and just learning about kind of the space of instant issuance, i.e. kind of really immediately creating a payment method or a mechanism to allow companies to be on the payment rails. And I became very excited about that because to me, it was in line with this notion of, you know, a technology that can really enable companies or people to do things better or faster or differently, that centered around innovation and helping that sort of digital transformation or the acceleration within embedded finance was really exciting to me. And so the more I researched it, the more I felt like there are not a lot of companies that point to that we're doing this. There's a lot of legacy players that were great at processing, you know, a gazillion transactions, but maybe less set up to help companies move quickly and be differentiating. And so at that point, I felt like this is an exciting opportunity. The market is massive. The more research I did, the more I felt like this is a wave. It's accelerating. There aren't a lot of competitors, and there are even fewer platforms that are modern. And so I connected with a former colleague of mine that I'd been working with for 10 or 15 years in the technology area. And we said, look, I think there's a real opportunity here. And that sort of then is how we sort of hatched the concept. Our model for Highnote is clearly around embedded finance, real-time issuance, integration, but really rethinking processing and really moving processing from the back office into a product construct so that what we've designed and implemented is really around a platform geared specifically towards companies that want to move quickly and be differentiated. So they don't want to just look like everybody else. And, they, you know, it's really about allowing for the innovation that is occurring and yet to occur with a platform that's built for purpose. And so that was the beginning of what Highnote is now.
That's fantastic. Let me double click on some of the words that you've used just to get us a deeper sense, right? So you said processing and embedded finance, and also this idea of being a platform that's fit for purpose in a product development process. And I think that's a really dense description that I'd love for you to open up even further. You know, so what is an example of a company displaying good product sense or having a product development practice into which High Note is going to be well integrated, you know, and then in your description of the platform that provides these processing APIs, like what is a use case? Like, what does that mean to be a platform rather than, you know, something else?
I'll take the second one first, and then we can move into the verticals and the specific examples. I think by platform, what we really mean is we're not building solutions specifically with different features and capabilities. It's more of an enabling platform with sort of open APIs that will allow the innovation to occur by our customers or by businesses that want to move quickly and do things differently. An example of that might be, let's take a vertical, let's take fleet. So this is the business where, you know, massive number of trucks, and they need to be managed in a way that allows for distribution of cards, the ability for these trucks to, you know, fill their tanks, and ultimately for truck drivers to be paid for miles driven and not necessarily on a two-week pay cycle. Traditionally, the fleet business has been sort of owned by a couple of very large incumbents in a more closed-loop environment. But now there are a number of innovative, fast-moving companies that are thinking about this problem differently and providing capabilities not only to the fleet companies, but also in the card product themselves. So things are, you know, capabilities around fraud, capabilities around kind of earned wage access, where you can provide sort of pay up capabilities, things around data and the ability to interrogate all of the data elements within the ISO 8583 message and or the level 2, level 3 data, which is a superset of information that's distributed by the networks on a nightly basis. And being able to assimilate that data, provide analytics, and therefore have better insight into not only their fraud, but also future products. This requires an integration with a product-based issuing platform, not very possible if you're working with, you know, existing sort of back office processors. And so it's for companies, like I think High Note is really designed for companies that want to bring the processing, the data, the analytics, business rules into their products or embed them into their operations so that they can better serve their customers. And so as a result, for us, because we're so new and to your question on what does it mean, we've really thought about designing this platform in a way that if a company comes to us and says, hey, can you expose these data elements to us in real time or in stream and allow us to have our own business rules that can make decisions that better serve our customers, you know, how long would that take? Or is that even possible? And for us, we love those sort of businesses because that's exactly how we've designed. We are a full stack issuer processor. So we don't sit on top of some other processor. So it's an important distinction because our ability to get access to kind of the bare metal, the bare bones, the core transaction feed, and make changes or add hooks or provide exposure to those elements, extend our APIs. That's de facto for us. That's how we design the platform. So those kind of questions and sort of business cases and use cases and experiences are really native to what we've designed. And I think, you know, other platforms that are out there, either incumbent or even current, sure, they can do it. They can do all of this. It's just a matter of how long does it take, and is it an edge case? Is it a bolt on? And I think that where our goal is to deliver, you know, responses to those innovations in ways that are consistent with our application architecture for the long term.
So I think that to me echoes back to your description of this, you know, this giant batch calculation that has to run for 15 hours before it gets to a result. And here what you're describing is essentially a gigantic money in motion pipe that in real time is able to not just pick out any particular data piece, but also do kind of business analytics and custom workflow stuff, and is able to do all of that through just open connectors for client developers.
That's right. It's many ways akin to like what, you know, what happened in the acquiring side 10, 15 years ago with Stripe and Braintree and others. It's just, it's been a little, it, in my opinion, it's just been a little slower on the issuing side. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, first and foremost, it's a regulated business, meaning, you know, there is a bank that is involved for sure. But I also feel like that's no reason that kind of modern capabilities can't successfully work within compliance and regulatory frameworks in ways that are still very innovative and fast moving and enabling for companies that want to move fast in their digital transformation strategies.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the regulatory and licensing issues? Where do you have to be licensed versus your customers? Where do they hold licenses? And sort of what's the, if you were to imagine the company kind of as a gear relative to your customers and other third parties, what do they have to bring to the table for you to be able to perform that function?
It's great. And a lot of people don't fully understand it. It's rightfully, it can be quite complex, but to try to simplify it, I think the number one kind of regulatory sort of body around issuance is in the banking. Like it is a bank is the regulated entity that allows for cards to be issued. So those 16 digit numbers you see on your credit or debit card, those ultimately map directly to a bank account. And so banks, as you know, also are heavily regulated. And so we are not a bank. We partner with banks in relationships that allow us to essentially, on behalf of the bank, issue cards and card numbers. And in order to do that, by extension, we need to not only understand what the regulatory and compliance related processes are, but we need to be really good at them. We need to ensure that we stay in front of, we have an understanding of that. And actually some of these things that need to be delivered to comply, we partner with other companies. So there's a notion of KYC or know your customer, which is essentially make sure that the individual that you are issuing a card to, you know, is a real individual, is not a criminal, is not a fraudster. And to do that, there's a certain amount of information that we need to collect on behalf of our partners. And then there are data services and there are algorithms that we execute, you know, that check with, you know, different agencies and businesses that give us that assurance that this is a real thing. This is just one specific example. But for Hainaut, we've integrated all of those components into the platform in a way that makes that consumer experience fairly frictionless for our customers. And that goes to this notion of program management, which is to say we are not just a sort of a processing platform, we are also a full stack program manager. So we enable the capabilities on behalf of our customers to ensure that they are compliant, that they pass regulatory and approvals, and that they are running programs with our bank partners that are consistent with the law. And that's our burden that we take on. And again, this goes to allowing our customers to not necessarily have to worry and to think through and to try to figure out how to partner with a bank. And, you know, we handle all of that so they can worry, they can think about innovating their business models and having a trusted partner that's not a burden and not some, you know, a platform to slow them down, but to in fact accelerate their vision and to light up new experiences, because we handle all of that stuff behind the scenes on their behalf.
That's fascinating. Thank you for opening that up. We're coming up on our time, but I really wanted to ask you about kind of the destination of the company as you see it. You know, so I think you've described some really powerful trends, some really powerful changes in how financial services products are packaged, distributed, where they go, and you seem to have an uncanny ability to be on trend. And so it's a pretty good signal for embedded finance, you know, and I think that's touching a lot of different parts of the industry and transforming it into sort of this performant infrastructure that you're talking about. You know, if everything goes right and the company grows and the pace of adoption and integration, you know, keeps up and grows and all of these things, what do you see as the state of play or the state of the art looking out, let's say five or more years forward? Like, what kinds of customers do you expect yourself powering? What scale do you think the company will be at? What does that picture look like for you?
That's a great question. I think, look, I just to be set the stage. Like, we are in the early stages of what is, I think, a very exciting transformation within payments. And I do believe that these are tailwinds that are accelerating in terms of not only expectations of consumers in terms of their digital integrated experiences. I think that that bar continues to lift, but there's an expectation on the ecosystem, the infrastructure, the banking kind of regulatory and compliance framework that we just talked about. And so as I look forward, I believe that having a modern platform that is designed for, yes, today's challenges and opportunities, but also designed for the future, knowing what we know now. You know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, when some of the existing platforms were designed, you know, it was hard to imagine, I think, where we are. There was no DoorDash. There was no need for a virtual card to pay a shopper and to protect your credentials. But as these use cases emerge and new business models begin to flourish, I think de facto platforms like ours, and there will be many, but like ours, who have been designed for scale and to address and unlock a lot of these capabilities, I think that's where things are headed. Things like having a unified platform that does both issuing and acquiring in a single platform to provide capabilities like closed loop processing or on-us transaction processing, I think that's definitely coming. Additional products like, you know, there's credit that's out there that we haven't talked about. There's a number of different capabilities from a product perspective that can be built into a platform that has been architected for these types of changes. And so the excitement for me is not necessarily being able to specifically answer your question as to what the world looks like in 5 years, but more so knowing that A, it's going to look tremendously different. And I believe the expectation and the innovation that's occurring within companies that we're talking to right now, you know, gives me a lot of confidence that, you know, if you've got the right team, which I think we do, you've got the right core principles around architecture, platform, scale, openness, data, and you're open to be flexible to adopting these new expectations of the world that's changing, you know, I think it's going to be a massive opportunity and a lot of fun, you know, to see what happens over the next 4 or 5 years. So we're keeping a pretty open mind about things, but knowing that the demand is there now, and we see it continuing to grow, and we're excited to be part of it.
John, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Listeners should check out highnoteplatform.com and of course, learn more about this really interesting and innovative company. Thank you so much for joining.
Lex, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Hi, everyone. That's it for this week's episode of the FinTech Blueprint. For more technical deep dives into all things fintech and decentralized finance, check out fintechblueprint.com and grab a free subscription to the newsletter. This is Lex, and I'll see you next time.